Accession number 10751, reel 2.
Mr. Briggs, reel 2.
In actual fact, she hadn't. She'd resumed course, but Admiral Holland assumed that she was heading back and consequently altered course to try to intercept on a new course. By the time Norfolk and Suffolk regained contact, Hood and Prince of Wales had lost an awful lot of ground, and consequently the action would not now take place until a later time. However, it became very obvious that action was going to be imminent, and consequently we went to action stations at midnight. Meanwhile, the destroyers were rapidly losing ground on us because the sea was pretty heavy and they couldn't maintain the speed that we were doing of 28 and a half knots. So the Admiral made a signal to him saying that, "Regret, if you cannot keep up this speed, I will have to press on without you." Consequently, by the time the action took place, the destroyers were about 50 miles astern. We gained contact with Bismarck on our radar at about 3 o'clock on the morning of the 24th of May. And at that time, she was about 30 miles on our starboard bow, and she was doing 29 knots herself, steaming out towards the Atlantic. Admiral Holland decided he would maintain a parallel course to her until such times as the weather moderated and visibility improved. Also, he knew what we didn't appreciate, and that was the fact that Hood, being a battle cruiser, they'd had to sacrifice a lot of armour for speed. So consequently, her deck armour was thin and vulnerable, and his object was to get in as close as he possibly could during the action, so that the fall of shot would be a flat trajectory rather than a higher plummeting effort from a longer range. And whereas our maximum gun range was originally 20 miles but reduced to 17 because of a rage, the maximum effective gun range was about 12 miles. Admiral Holland wanted to get in to 8 to get a definite flatter trajectory of it. And he turned towards the Bismarck at about 4 o'clock. We sighted her just after 5 at a range of 20 miles. And that was very fine on the starboard bow. Just the spotting tops of the two ships. We got in to about the 12-mile range, and we then opened fire. Again, fine on the starboard bow, and consequently, the after guns could not be brought into action. They couldn't bear sufficiently far enough for it, so we could only use the forward gun turrets. Prince of Wales was on our starboard quarter, and she could also only use her forward gun turrets. We'd fired about 6 salvos, I suppose, before Bismarck replied. She had obviously been taken completely by surprise, because although she realised that there were 2 heavy cruisers in the shadowing her, she had no idea that there were 2 capital ships in the vicinity because of the radio silence that we'd been keeping. We hit Bismarck, I think it was with the 3rd salvo, and that caused that hit one of her oil tanks and caused a leak in one of those oil tanks, which I think subsequently led to her rediscovery after the action. We I said we'd fired about six salvos before she replied. Now her gunnery was extremely accurate. Oh, we also made the mistake then of assuming that Bismarck was the leading ship. We could only see the spotting tops originally. In actual fact, the leading ship was the Prinz Eugen. So we had to shift target as soon as the mistake was realised. The Bismarck's third salvo went over. The next salvo fell short, and the fifth salvo hit us. And that hit at the base of the mainmast. I was on the compass platform with the admiral, so I knew exactly what was going on. But we couldn't see aft because of the enclosed bridge. All we knew was we'd been hit because the ship shuddered and we were thrown off our feet, etc. The gunnery commander, Commander Gregson, went out onto the starboard wing of the bridge and came back and reported to the captain that there was a hit at the base of the mainmast, and there was a fire around the 4-inch ready-use lockers there. These were the secondary armament, the actual ready-use lockers, and the exploding ammunition going up there. Now, what struck me at that time was the unreality of it. It just wasn't happening. You mentioned earlier about the calmness. Yes, the calmness was there. It just seemed as if you're watching a film. It wasn't part of it. The gunnery commander coming back with a fixed grin on his face and reporting this thing to him. And the captain ordered that fire be left until all the ready-use ammunition had exploded, and that the boat deck should be cleared of all unwounded personnel until such times as it all gone by. By that time we got into the range that we wanted to get into, and the admiral ordered both ships to alter course to bring the after guns into action. It was just as we were altering course that the next salvo hit us, and that virtually penetrated down into X and Y magazines, the two after magazines. I personally didn't hear any explosion at all. Again, the ship shuddered and we were all thrown off our feet, and all I saw was a gigantic sheet of flame which shot round the front of the compass platform. I got to my feet and the ship had started listing to starboard, and she'd gone about 10 degrees, I suppose, when she righted herself and started going over to port, and she carried on going over. At the same time, I heard the quartermaster report at the voice back, "Steering gear, Gonzo," and the captain ordered change over to emergency conning. And by that time she was going over, and we realised that she just wasn't coming back. There was no order given to abandon ship, it wasn't necessary. She'd gone, I suppose, about 45 degrees when we just realised that she just wasn't coming back, and we started to make our way out. Now, I went over to the starboard door of the compass platform, and it was as I got to that door, the gunnery officer was going out just in front of me. The navigating officer stood to one side to let me go through and follow behind me. And I was about halfway down the ladder to the Admiral's Bridge, the next bridge down, when I was dragged into the water. I realised that there was a deckhead above me, and I had to get clear of this. Kicked out away from it as fast as I could, and at the same time I felt myself being dragged down, and again you can get to such a stage that you just can't do anymore, and I could feel myself being dragged down and down and down, and I just couldn't do anymore. And I felt quite a feeling of peace. And that sounds ridiculous, but you just like peace and calm type thing. And then I suddenly seemed to shoot to the surface, and I came up and I looked around, and the ship was vertical, and the ship was vertical with the water, and B turret was just going under, so the two forward turrets and the whole of the bow were about vertical with the water and about 50 yards away from me. I panicked. I turned and swam as fast as I could away from her. There were lots of little 3 foot square Fakali rafts floating around. I managed to get on one of these, and the water again was about 4 inches thick with oil. And again I looked around, and she'd gone. But there was a fire on the water where she'd been. And with the oil around, I panicked, and I turned, swam away as fast as I could. And when I again looked around, the fire had gone out. And over on the other side were the other two. We swam towards each other. They were on the same 3 foot square Kali rafts. The midshipman had managed to sit up on his. Bob Tilburn, the able seaman, and myself, we were just sprawled chest down on ours. We managed to hold on to one another's rafts for a while. But what I couldn't understand was the midshipman and myself had both been on the compass platform. The able seaman had been on the boat deck, and he'd seen all the carnage that was going on down there. I went out of the starboard door of the compass platform, and I came up on the port side. I couldn't understand why. Tilburn and Dundas had both had come up on the starboard side. Now, we saw the Prince of Wales disappearing, still firing, because the ship in action naturally won't stop to pick up survivors. And she had reported to the Admiralty and Commander-in-Chief, Hood sunk, very little hope of survivors. I also saw in the distance the tops of the three funnels of one of the cruisers. And they then disappeared. We've floated around. The midshipman was sitting up on his raft, and I was highly indignant about this. I wanted to do the same. The more I tried to sit up, the more I kept upsetting the raft and what have you. And eventually, Bob Tilburn said, "No, come on, you can't do it. Stay where you are." And then the only after a while, I think it must have been hypothermia. I just wanted to go to sleep. And after about an hour, Bob Tilburn said, there's a flying boat. And we looked up and there's a Catalina flying around but in the distance. And we splashed the water and shouted, but obviously they couldn't see us. It was impossible. And then the next thing I knew was Bill Dundas, the midshipman, said, there's a destroyer over there. And I looked up and I saw H-27. I started shouting, "Electra, Electra," and they joined in with me. And apparently there were two destroyers. The Commander-in-Chief just couldn't believe the fact that there were very little hope of survival, and he sent two of the destroyers that had originally been with us, detached them to look for survivors. I say I only saw Electra, but she came up. And she picked the three of us up. And by that time, we virtually couldn't move. And they threw scrambling nets over the side, and they dropped in the water themselves to pull us out. What I do remember is, I think it must have been the chief bosun's mate, threw a rope as I came along to the scrambling nets, and which I did manage to get hold of, and they said, "Don't you let go of that." It must have been complete reaction. So you bet your bloody life I won't. I distinctly remember that. And they pulled us out. And they cut the clothing off us and wrapped us in blankets. And Bill Dundas was taken to the wardroom. Bob Tilburn and I were taken along to the sick bay. And it was cramps started to set in after that when the feeling started to come back. That was the most agonising side of it. And then when we were coming round a bit, we were taken along to the mess decks, and we were plied with lots and lots of rum, God knows what, which I think was a good thing, because it made us violently ill. It had the effect of warming us, naturally, but it made us violently ill. And my only thing was I'd swallowed a lot of oil, and that brought most of that up. Bill Dundas, he was been on the coast platform, as I say, and he made his way out. He kicked out one of the armour-plated windows of the forward part of the compass platform. How on earth he managed to do it, God alone knows. And he sprayed his ankle in doing so, and he went out that way. Bob Tilburn had the most miraculous escape of the lot. He was on the boat deck, and he went over on the port side where she was going over. And one of the roof aerials, which had broken, tangled around his legs underwater, and he had to take his knife out and cut himself free underwater. And he'd got a small wound in his knee. The only thing that was wrong with me is I'd swallowed some oil. We were taken by Electra into Reykjavik, where we were landed at the military hospital there. Taken along, and the Padre came along to see us and sent telegrams off to our relatives. And we were informed that we would be coming back, being sent back to UK in one of the ferries there between UK and Reykjavik, which is the Royal Ulsterman. We were put aboard the Royal Ulsterman the following day, segregated into cabins, Bob and I in one, and Bill Dundas in another, and we were told we had to stay there. We weren't allowed to talk to anybody, and we were treated flat like royalty, but virtually, but we weren't allowed to talk to anyone. When we got back to Greenock, we were met there by an officer and taken straight to a train, the night train, placed in a reserve compartment aboard there, and sent off down to London. And we were told we hadn't got to talk to anyone on the way down. We were met at the station in London by an officer in a car, and we were taken along to Admiralty, the old Admiralty building. This was about 6 o'clock in the morning. We were met by the duty captain, given breakfast, and then told that we were going to be interviewed by the Second Sea Lord, who was Vice Admiral Whitworth, the previous Admiral in Hood. And he, when we were ushered in to see him, he virtually had tears in his eyes. And he knew me, because at one time, whilst he was in Hood, I was a flag lieutenant's messenger. I'd been sent down from the bridge to the signal office to deliver a message. And I came charging across the Admiral's Bridge in the middle of the night, bumped into him, knocked him straight on his backside, and I stopped a blast from everybody downwards. When we went into that room, Second Sea Lord's office, he looked at all three of us and he came up and said, "I know you, don't I?" I said, "Yes, sir." And he looked at all and said, "Yes," he said, you'll be all right. All you need is a haircut." And he said, what had actually happened? And we all gave our version. And he said, "Well, you realise you mustn't talk to anyone about it at the moment." Turned out the duty captain, and said, what instructions have they got for them? Oh, he said, "They've got to report to their depots." "Oh, no, no," he said, "send them on leave." And we said, "Well, how long for?" He said, "We'll send for you when the court of inquiry comes up." So we were given rough and ready uniforms. At that time, we were still dressed up in duffel coats and God knows what, whatever we got from the destroyer. So we were given rough and ready uniforms and sent on leave. I had a message from, or a letter from Mercury saying, "Your leave expires 14 days from the date you went on leave." And like a fool, I came back. The next thing I knew was I bumped into the other two when the Court of Inquiry came up 3 months later. in London. And this was the president was Admiral Hugh Walker, and they interviewed each of us separately, and the conclusion that they came to was that we'd all said the same thing, that we'd been dragged down and then suddenly seemed to shoot the surface, and they came to the conclusion that it must have been a boiler that had burst underwater, and that we got caught in an air bubble and came up with that. But there wasn't another soul, and the only thing we can think of there is that those on the upper deck, most of those on the upper deck, would have been killed or maimed by the first hit, and those below decks just wouldn't stand a hope, and the majority of the others on the upper deck would have been taken care of by suction. That was that.
If we can go back to the pursuit of the Bismarck, when the Hood was pursuing the German battleship, what was the atmosphere on board the Hood?
Well, it was very, very tense. We'd had so many false alarms with the pursuit of Deutschland and Scharnhorst and Eisner, etc. We'd had so many false alarms that at first, when we were on the way up to Reykjavik, Hafjord, when the captain broadcast to say to give the ship's company the gen of what was going on, we thought, just another false alarm type thing. But it was when the first enemy report came through from Suffolk that they'd been sighted, it was then that we realised that there was going to be an action and that we were going to be in it. That was when the tenseness started to creep in. There was a mixture of excitement and tension and apprehension, but mainly excitement. It was something that we'd been waiting for, something that we'd been wanting all the way along. There wasn't a man aboard that ship that would had any doubts about her capabilities. She was the epitome of British sea power. She was the mightiest ship afloat, and we were proud of it. There was fear, yes. As far as I personally was concerned, I was frightened. But my main fear was fear of showing fear. It wasn't fear of death. It was fear of being maimed and not being able to do anything about it. But the main thing is, it was fear of showing fear. But it was mainly excitement.
You say that you felt that she was the mightiest ship afloat, but did you know of the weaknesses in her armour?
No, we didn't. I don't think very many people did. Possibly some of the more senior officers may well have done, yes. You see, it was always intended that weakness should be rectified. But in peacetime, she could never be spared. She was always the flag waving cruises and showing the flag and all that type of thing. And in wartime, she could never be spared for the length of time it would have taken to have done the job.
What kind of a view personally did you have of the Bismarck?
Well, as I say, I was as flag lieutenant's messenger. My position was with the command, and the admiral had decided that he was going to conduct the battle from the compass platform rather than the admiral's bridge. So, although the captain was fighting the ship from the compass platform, the admiral was controlling the battle from there. So I was in a position to see everything that was going on and to hear everything that was going on. And I kept pestering the flag lieutenant, you know, and he was very helpful. He was telling me what was happening. The admiral's intentions were that once action had been joined, that Hood and Prince of Wales should take on Bismarck, and that the two cruisers, Norfolk and Suffolk, under Rear Admiral Wake Walker, should be brought up to take on the Prince Eugen. and that the six destroyers that we'd had to leave behind, which were 50 miles behind, should be brought up to carry out torpedo attacks as necessary. But things happened with such bewildering rapidity when the action took place. I mean, from the time that we opened fire to the time that Hood was fatally hit was about 5 minutes, and she went down in less than three from the time that she was hit until she disappeared.
So if you hadn't been briefed by the officer, would you have been able to understand what was happening in the battle?
Yes, but not as well as what I did. The remaining ships, those below decks, etc., were given a running commentary on what was going on by the padre over the intercom. So they would be getting a picture, but not as clear a picture as we on the compass platform did.
How did the padre deliver that kind of information, in an excited or calm way?
It was a very calm, matter of fact, running commentary effort. We have just sighted the two topmasts of the enemy ships. We are turning towards to intercept, and we would be opening fire in very shortly, and that type of thing. She has been hit, and then that hit, that sound you heard was Hood being hit at the base of the mainmast. And it was a steady running commentary of that type of thing.
What did the Bismarck shells sound like as they were coming over?
Very much like an express train going through a tunnel type thing. Okay. That's the best way I think of describing it.
Was it a terrifying noise?
Yes. Yes, it was. I hesitate because, yes, it was a terrifying noise, but you got the, feeling of unreality. It didn't seem to be taking place. It's not happening to me. It can't be happening. And I think, really, that was where all your basic training came into being, that you did your reactions automatically, without thinking.
Was the atmosphere on board the ship calm, or was there any kind of panic? Or?
No, it was a very, very calm atmosphere. Apart from after the hit, you heard the screams and the noise of the carnage that was going on, and that caused quite a little bit of apprehension.